This is Florida Matters. I'm Steve Newborn. Today we're going to take a look at life behind the front lines of the war on the coronavirus. Many first responders, doctors, nurses, and people just willing to lend a hand have forsaken the relative comfort of their own hometowns and ventured into the epicenter of the virus outbreak. That would be New York City, where more than 200,000 confirmed cases of the virus have so far resulted in more than 17,000 deaths. That's by far the highest concentration of both cases and deaths in the U.S. A little later in the show, we'll talk with a recent graduate from the University of South Florida's nursing school who went up to the big city for the first time for 3 weeks during the heart of the outbreak. First, we'll hear from some military reservists who got an assignment recently that they never could have imagined. They were asked to don civilian gear and head to New York when the city's hospitals and morgues were overwhelmed. WUSF Stephanie Colombini reports on what these Air Force reservists from the 927th Air Refueling Wing at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa experienced.
Lieutenant Joseph O'Brien was in his pajamas creating a PowerPoint presentation for his job as a nurse educator in Orlando when he got a call. It was his other job, the reserves, and he had 4 hours to report to MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa to head to New York City. This was in early April, and O'Brien and his comrades received an unusual assignment for the military. They were to ditch the uniforms and work alongside civilian health workers in city hospitals overwhelmed by the coronavirus pandemic.
There was no way to prepare for some of the things that we were seeing.
O'Brien worked as an emergency room nurse at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx as hospitalizations peaked.
All the rooms were full of COVID patients, all the hallway beds full of COVID patients. And when we ran out of hallway beds, we got chairs and people would be sitting. If they were able to sit, they would be sitting in a chair with oxygen on their face. It was really disaster management.
O'Brien describes the painful decisions he and other health workers had to make surrounded by sick and dying patients with limited resources to treat them.
If we really didn't feel like there was much we could do for that patient, we would move on. And you could see the fright in their eyes because they knew it. And that took a lot of time to sort of come to terms with.
Another reservist from Florida, Lieutenant Colonel Raj Talati, worked as an attending physician at Jacoby. He says it was hard to see patients without their loved ones nearby since visitation at hospitals was banned for safety measures. He got emotional as he remembered holding some patients' hands so they wouldn't be alone.
As a provider, when somebody dies without their family, it's tough. I have to, have to be a family for a lot of people.
Over time, the situation got better. At Jacoby, hospital staff played Rachel Platten's fight song over the loudspeakers as patients were taken off breathing tubes.
This is my fight song. Take back my life.
And Frank Sinatra's New York, New York when patients went home.
Start spreading the news. I'm leaving today.
As the days went on, the music played more often. Colonel Jennifer Robin Ratcliffe helped lead the New York mission. She was involved in the complicated decision of when the reservists could leave. Though the disease hasn't gone away, once hospitals were mostly treating non-coronavirus patients, they decided it was time.
I know we can take care of everybody, but I honestly believe people survived this disease and went home to their families because the military was there to help them.
Now the hundreds of reservists who served in New York hospitals have come home. They were ordered to quarantine for 2 weeks. Lieutenant O'Brien chose to do so at the base hotel at MacDill out of concern for his infant daughter. Ratcliffe went home to her dogs in Orlando, and Talati returned to his wife and teenage sons in Port St. Lucie. They're eager to return to some sense of normal life, but know that may not be possible, especially with cases on the rise in Florida and other parts of the country. Talati's urging everyone to follow public health guidelines about physical distancing and wearing masks.
It doesn't affect you till you see these people die. And we need to be mindful. It's not over. We don't need any more unnecessary deaths on something that's preventable.
The reservists said they talked with leadership about whether they would need to deploy again if another healthcare system gets overwhelmed. And while it doesn't seem likely, they know it's possible. All three said they'd willingly answer the call, but hope for everyone's sake they don't have to. Stephanie Colombini, WUSF 89.7 News.
Now we'll come back to the Tampa Bay area and speak with a registered nurse who ventured into the Big Apple during the worst times of the pandemic. Victoria Mejia is a certified registered nurse anesthetist, now working at North Florida Regional Medical Center in Gainesville after graduating from the USF College of Nursing. I talked to Victoria via Zoom from her home in Gainesville.
You probably never thought that you would be having this kind of an adventure, if I could use that word in quotes, right? What prompted you to go up there to begin with?
So I think the answer to that is pretty twofold. First off, I'm a Christian. I believe Jesus is my Savior, and He commands us to love others as we love Him and as He loves us. So that is my biggest reason. There was a need for, and there was like a cry out for help based on the call that I received. They just needed a lot of help. And as a Christian, I couldn't just say no to that. And then second is, as a healthcare provider, that's all we want to do. That's why we get into our profession, at least most of us. I know that's why I got into my profession. So if I'm able to use my specific skill set for good, there's no way that I would ever say no to doing that.
I know you're doing this for the greater good. Was there one particular thing that prompted you that said, I got to go right now? Or was it just kind of snowball? You saw what was happening up there and you said, we really needed help. Or was there one event that you said, I got to go up there,
yeah,
I got to do something?
I don't think that there was just one event. I think it was just like, they need help, I need to help. And that was kind of it. My husband was like, ooh, I don't know. My best friend, I don't know. Are you sure you want to do this? My family, no. Like, anyone else can go. I'm like, yeah, but I'm a nurse anesthetist. Like, I can work as a respiratory therapist. I can work as a nurse anesthetist. I can work as an advanced practice provider in the ICU, in the ER. I can work as a nurse anywhere they need me to. So it's like, I can fill so many positions for them. So I feel like it's not a want, it's a need. Like, they need me to go. And I would be an awful person if I didn't.
All right. Have you ever been to the big city before? This must have been quite the experience for you if you hadn't.
No, I've never been to New York City before. And I'm actually from a really small town called Brooksville, Florida.
I know where that
is. Yeah. It's getting bigger now. But when I grew up there, it was even smaller than it is now. But yeah, being in the big city was definitely a huge change for me, even compared to Tampa. I am not the concrete jungle kind of person. I like to have woods behind me and lots of acres around me. So that was a different experience for sure.
Now, there is a Coney Island hot dog stand in Brooksville that I've been to. I know that. So that must have been familiar to you, right?
That's famous.
Tell me about your experience when you first got up there. Where'd they have you go? Were you in a hotel? Did they have a place for you? How'd that all work?
So I got on the airplane and I didn't know where I was staying. They said I was going to stay at, they had a hotel room for me, but I didn't know where. I didn't have any transportation from the airport to the hotel room. So I got on the plane just like, okay, we're just going to figure this out. And they told me on Thursday that I was leaving on Sunday. So that's kind of just how it worked out. I was like, all right, let's do this. So I show up to the airport. I take the first leg of my flight. When I got off that first leg, they called me and they're like, hey, you're going to be staying at the Marriott Marquis in Times Square. And I was like, okay, cool. That sounds awesome. And they're like, you're going to have a driver going to pick you up and take you to the hotel. So I was like, okay. So then on the second leg of the flight, I land and the driver is like waiting for me and he comes and he helps me with my bags. And I was like, wow, this is really nice. I wasn't expecting this. So it was pretty cool. But we kind of just like figured things out as we went. I had a hospital location that I started at for the first week I was there.
Which hospital was that?
So the hospitals don't really want to be named in a lot of things. We've done a couple interviews.
Really?
Yeah, that was kind of like an awkward position to be put in, like, because I named one time and I got some feedback on that. So I was at one of the hospitals in the city at the beginning, and I was there for about a week and a half and then transferred to Queens. So that was new. I wasn't expecting that, but went with it.
All right. I got to ask you this. Were you in Elmhurst by any chance? Because I read a lot of stories about what happened in Elmhurst in the hospitals.
No, I wasn't at Elmhurst.
Okay. All right. So tell me about your experience when you were there. First of all, when were you there? And were people really overwhelmed? Was it still at that stage where this was new and everybody was scrambling for PPEs and equipment and there were shortages of everything?
Yeah. So I was there throughout the month of April. I left April 5th and started work April 6th. And I left to come back home April 29th, I believe. So it was still pretty bad. There was like the peak while I was there. I would say that as far as PPE goes, you know, normally when you're dealing with these situations, if you have someone that you're considering to be on droplet precautions or airborne precautions, you know, we're all wearing N95s. If you had a patient under those circumstances, you would change your mask, you would change your gown, you would change your gloves, you would change everything that you're wearing, all of your PPE, in between patients. So in these hospitals, you couldn't do that. Otherwise, you would just be getting in and out of PPE all day and not actually doing anything because it takes so long. Also, we weren't going to take off. I never took off my N95 mask while I was at the hospital because I didn't feel comfortable and I did not want to come home positive. So the way that we would do it is you walk into the unit, you put on your entire, like, you know, suit and your gown, and you put on all your face shield and your goggles and your two masks, and then you kind of go into the unit and you change gloves throughout every patient. So since that was the standard and the way that we were doing things, because it was the only way that made sense, yes, we had enough PPE because that was the way it had to be done. If we would have been changing between every single patient, no, we would not have. But that was not an expectation that I had because that wouldn't have been a good way to care for these patients at all.
You were there, you said, in early April, right? Things were still pretty heavy at the time. Did you ever feel like you were overwhelmed or you weren't getting enough support from people? Because I'm sure people are just running around just trying to keep people on ventilators alive. I mean, what was that experience like? Did you feel like you got the support that you needed as a pretty new nurse?
Yeah, so I'm not a new nurse at all. I just started anesthesia. So I was an ICU nurse. I was a charge nurse in the ICU. Prior to going back to anesthesia school. So I worked as a nurse for roughly almost 3 years. So the ICU is a place where I feel totally comfortable and confident. So my first day in Queens, I walked in. Normally your ratios for ICU patients are 2-1. You've got 2 patients to 1 ICU nurse. First day, no orientation, like very minimal. It was like a 2-hour orientation. So I don't know how to chart. I don't know how to do anything like that because our role, what they said we were going to do, is be a resource for the other nurses coming in as CRNAs. So when I entered, they were like, can you take patients? Like the first person I saw was so frazzled. She's like, oh, I see you're a CRNA. Can you take patients? And I was like, yeah, all right, let's do it. Sure. So my first day, I got 6 ICU patients and they were all on ventilators, all on drips. They're all sedated, intubated, multiple drips. And we have these machines, or patients will be on like a continuous dialysis. It's called CRRT, continuous renal replacement therapy. Normally those patients are 1-1. So in my bundle of 6 ICU patients, I had 2 of those and they were all very, very sick. So that was a tad overwhelming. And then she says, by the way, you're the charge nurse and you have an orientee. And I was like, you do realize it's my first day. And she was like, I know, but out of all of these nurses up here, you're the only one with ICU experience. So you have to like help. And I was like, all right, let's just do it. I can do this. So I said a little prayer and I went about my day and I just was like, okay, kind of assigned out the duties. Like you're going to chart, you're going to track I's and O's. If your blood pressure goes out of these ranges, call me. Your patient starts coughing on your ventilator, call me. And so it ended up being fantastic because everyone that I worked with, we had people from everywhere. We had endoscopy nurses. We had staff OR nurses. We had just a slew of nurses. We had a long-term healthcare nurse and everyone just chipped in and they were awesome. They did such a good job. And I couldn't have asked for a better team on my first day. I was very, that would have been my most overwhelming day, but they just made it so good.
So that was your first day. Did it get any easier? Or, I mean, I'd imagine there must have been some days that were really rough and maybe you wondered, why am I here? Did you think about that at all? At least cross your mind a little?
Yeah, for sure. So the hardest part, obviously that was overwhelming in a sense of like work structure, just being totally, you know, flipped upside down and something that, you know, it was just a lot of work and overwhelming in that sense of like, can I get it all done? I'm nervous. So that was very difficult. It definitely got better towards the end of my stay. when I was leaving, I actually had like my last day, like a 3-to-1 ratio. So that was half of what I had the first day. So it also made me feel better that when I was leaving, you know, things are getting better and I don't feel like I'm abandoning these people that I've grown to like, grown very fond of while I've been here. So that was really nice. The part that didn't get any easier, normally when you work in the ICU or, you know, you do any stints in the ER, like you'll have patients that will pass away. And that's just part of it, unfortunately. And we pride ourselves on being able to save most of them. And we know that if we work hard enough, a lot of times, unless they're in an end stage of something, a lot of times we can really help them. The defeating part of all of this, no matter what you did, no matter how hard you worked, it didn't always matter. And it wasn't like these people were so unhealthy. They were coming in and they had smoked all of their lives, or they had drank all of their lives, or anything like that. We had, you know, healthy 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s coming in and, you know, having to eventually say like, okay, enough is enough on those people. That was really hard, and that never got easier.
We now continue our talk via Zoom with Victoria Mejia from her home in Gainesville about how she felt about volunteering to go to a series of New York City hospitals that were overwhelmed during the worst times of the coronavirus outbreak.
Did you ever feel helpless to change a situation? Like you wish you could and just there was nothing you can do? These people were too far gone or you didn't have enough supplies or anything like that?
Yeah, I definitely did feel helpless a few times. Something that I love to do, and I've done this since I was in the ICU, when I know that someone, you know, we've maxed out everything, we've maxed out all of their drips, we've done every last-ditch effort that we can possibly think of, which on these patients is, you know, we proned them. A lot of them were on these machines called oscillators, which is a very last-ditch effort. Their vent settings were just insane. And these, like, very high peeps, and they had super high, like, pressures just because of the nature of this disease. They were maxed out on every single drip that you could think of, and they just weren't getting better. They were getting worse. They were clotting off on their dialysis machine. So on a few of those, we reached a point where like, okay, well, we're not going to be able to do this anymore. And we need this machine to be used for someone that's not clotting off on it every 10 minutes. So you have to call it quits on a few patients that, you know, you're not going to be able to save. That was very difficult and made me feel very helpless. And then I love being able to sit there and hold my patient's hand as they're passing away, because you can tell based on their vital signs, everything that's going on, when that's going to happen. However, I can remember just one time there was this patient, you know, no family is there, so you're the only one. And I refuse to let someone leave this earth alone. So, excuse me.
I understand, Victoria. You sometimes feel like you have to play God, I guess. You know, you have to choose who can continue and who can't continue. It must be very tough on somebody, especially for somebody of faith like you.
Yeah. So at this point, there was a patient who he was passing away, and I wanted to sit and hold his hand. And so I had my phone in a bag and I played just like calming, relaxing music, and I put it next to his ear. And I was holding his hand, and then another patient started coding. So I had to run over to that patient. And I was like, there's no way I'm not going to be with this patient during this time. And there aren't enough people. So we were able to stabilize that patient just in time for me to run back over and grab this guy's hand as he passed away. And that, I mean, just, you know, fearing that that would happen when I wasn't there, that was really hard for sure.
Yeah, Victoria, this must have been really exhausting for you. I'd imagine at the end of your, how long were you there? 3 weeks? About a month?
Yeah, just over 3 weeks.
I'd imagine at the end of 3 weeks, you were probably ready to come home, or you had enough, or were you up for more?
No, I was definitely ready to come home. In anesthesia, our job is just, you know, most of us ICU nurses, we went back to school because, you know, working at the bedside in ICU is like mentally, physically, and emotionally draining. I would say that in the OR, it is generally just mentally draining. So you take out two of those factors. So I was tired by the end. And then having to, you know, just carry all this load of like emotional distress, just knowing that you are the only person with them and you are taking on the, I wouldn't, maybe like the burden of being their entire support because their family just can't be there. And so you're taking on that burden as well as, you know, the healthcare burden. And then you're just like physically exhausted because everything was so, so busy, but I refused to not turn my patients every 2 hours. I refused to not give them oral care every 2 hours like we normally do on patients when we only have two. So for that reason, I just never sat down and I was pretty exhausted by the time I left. But I also felt very, very confident that I gave the best care that I could possibly give. And so I knew that like my job was done by the time I was leaving.
Is there anything you drew on mentally to keep you going in some of those hard times? Any thoughts of people that you knew or somebody who you knew that was sick and you thought you wouldn't want this happening to them too?
I kind of would imagine my family members as my patients because there are times when, you know, you don't mean to do it, but you can block out someone as like, oh, it's just a patient. And, you know, you can, because it gets to be too much for you in your own mind. And I refuse to let that happen to me. So when I was an elderly man, I would think of my grandpa, like, how would I want him to be treated in this situation? Elderly woman, I would think of my grandma. When it was a young woman, I would think of my sister-in-law. When, you know, I would put my own family in those beds and how would I want them to be taken care of? And I would try my best to take care of them exactly how I would want someone to take care of my family if I wasn't there to advocate for them and to help them.
Were there any other visiting nurses that you got to know at all, or were they mostly locals? Were you part of a group at all?
At the first hospital I was at, actually one of my buddies from anesthesia school, he was there. His name is Matt. He was there, and that was a godsend because, you know, we were anxious our first day, but we got to go to the same hospital, which just ended up working out. I didn't even know he was going until I think like the day that I was arriving, I found out. So that was amazing, having him as like a support system. And so we would meet up at night, like for a debriefing, because we had been warned about, you know, the issues of mental illness after coming back from something like this. So we would meet up for a debriefing nearly every night and just talk about kind of like the worst stuff that you saw that day, because you're not going to go home and tell your family that. And that really helped, definitely, to be able to like process, you know, and file those things in your brain so that, you know, you can use them for good and for learning experiences, you know, when you get home. And so they don't just sit there and eat away at you. So that was really nice. And then also I had another doctor, an anesthesiologist that I work with, Dr. Mayo. He was at the same hotel I was at. He was working at a different hospital, but he was in the room above me. So he and I got to chit chat. We went to Central Park a few times together. So that was very nice.
Yeah, I was wondering if you got to see the city at all. Probably there was nobody outside, right? I've seen some pictures of it, and it looked like nuclear winter there. There was nobody left, right? Did you have any kind of a social life, or were you working 20-hour days, basically?
Yeah, so I was working pretty much, when you account the time that it took me to get to and from the hospital, it would be about 15 hours. So when you get home and you finally can take off your whole headgear of PPE, you just want to go to sleep. You want oxygen and you want to go to sleep. So you're not really into like, you know, getting up and going out. And I would work 2 days on, one day off, 2 days on, one day off. And so on my day off, I pretty much went to Central Park nearly every time because, like I said, I grew up in the country. And so that to me is just like, I'm breathing fresh air. I'm in this beautiful, beautiful place. And oh, it was just amazing. That was definitely like my saving grace while I was there. Because I'm not a city girl.
Yeah, it must be kind of weird walking the streets with nobody around, right?
Oh, yeah. You know, since I've never been there, I don't know how it normally is. And so I was actually joking with my friend Matt. I was like, wow, you know what? This is probably the best time for me to see New York because I think it's great. Like, you know, like this with just, you know, I walk straight to Central Park and I walk right on home. And I don't have to, you know, wait for cars to go by. I don't have to, no one's out. It was pretty nice.
Sounds like a nice experience. Victoria, I'd like to ask you if there are any lessons you learned that you think you can apply to the rest of your life, not just your professional life, but the rest of your life in general.
I think that honestly, you know, as someone in healthcare, a lot of times you kind of become your own support system and you don't expect to go home and tell your family about things. You know, you just internalize it and you just deal with it and it is what it is. But when it's, you know, such a large quantity of just awful things that have happened, you have to turn somewhere and you have to talk to someone. And I feel like what I've learned through all of this, something that I will definitely take on with me, is the ability to rely on my family and my friends for support, and on my fellow healthcare workers too. A lot of times we would joke things off and we'd just be like, oh, you know, start laughing about something totally inappropriately to anyone else who's not in healthcare. However, to us, that's how we deal with it. That's how we move on. But when it's, you know, such a massive quantity of terrible things, you have to talk it through. And I really utilize my family for a lot of that. So I think going forward, for just my own mental and like emotional health, using my family and just, you know, I don't even always have to tell them what's going on, but really leaning on them for support and not feeling like I have to keep it all inside. You always feel like you need to be this strong house. I don't need to be a strong house. And I went to my parents' house in Brooksville after all of this, and I stayed with them for a little over a week while I was in quarantine. And I was in their guest house, so, you know, we weren't in contact really, but they were just, I couldn't hug them, I couldn't do anything, but they were just there, and they just would sit 6 feet away from me and just listen to whatever I had to say. And normally I wouldn't share those things, but I feel like I've really learned to be a sharer and to allow others, you know, in, and to, you know, that it's not too much for everyone, because I always would bear that burden because I thought it was too much for anyone else. But, you know, people are a lot stronger. They're a lot more resilient than I thought they were.
You know, and after you've been through something like this, everything else kind of seems pretty minor in comparison, doesn't mm-hmm. it?
For sure, definitely.
All right, Victoria Mejia is a nurse anesthetist who went up to New York, and a USF graduate from Brooksville, speaking to us via Zoom from her home in Gainesville. Victoria, thank you so much for talking to us today. I appreciate what you did, and I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. I'd like to thank Victoria Mejia, WUSF Stephanie Colombini, and all the brave first responders who put their personal safety at risk to help others during the worst pandemic in modern times. You can read more about this on our website, wusfnews.org. I'm Steve Newborn. Thanks for listening.